We are rolling. Hey, David.
Hey, Mark. How's it going?
Good, good. This is Mark Goldberg with UN Dispatch, speaking with David Sullivan from the Enough Project. David, so I've been, actually, maybe first things first, you should say what it is exactly you do at the Enough Project and what your precise title is.
Sure thing. I'm a research associate with the Policy Shop here at the Enough Project, so helping to take our field-based research and turn that into strategy papers, both to influence folks in the U.S. government to more effectively respond to genocide and crimes against humanity in Africa and around the world, but also to work with the activist groups that are pushing policy here in the U.S.
Yeah, so I think it's I feel like, you know, we've had a few folks from Enough on this program before, but I think it's fair to say Enough Project is sort of a hybrid between a think tank and an activist group that thinks and activates on issues relating to genocide and mass atrocities. And you, David, I've been following your work recently on the issue of conflict minerals, specifically conflict minerals in the Congo, and I think that will be the subject of our conversation today. So I guess to start, maybe set the scene for us. What is a conflict mineral, and why should we care about it?
Sure thing. Well, right now in eastern Congo, we have a war that's been going on for more than a decade. It's the deadliest war in the world. Since World War II, killed more than 5 million people. And in no small part, the conflict that's been ongoing there, the violence that's been raging, is fueled by trade in what we call conflict minerals. They're minerals that are either the mines themselves are controlled by armed groups, or the taxation of the trade by armed groups allows those rebels and militias to continue to finance their operations and carry out some of the worst human rights abuses in the world. Now, these minerals ultimately wind up in consumer electronics products, among other places. And so the laptops and cell phones and whatnot that we're actually using to have this exchange today are key components of those are made by these minerals that are found in eastern Congo.
Okay. So maybe to get into it, I'll ask you. So I'm recording this now, obviously, on a camera that, Bob Wright, the founder of Blogging Heads, sent to me. I'm wondering, how is it that sort of this camera here, this that may or may not be contributing to violence in the Congo?
Well, it's probably contributing in a couple of different ways. There's actually four minerals that we've identified as that are the ones that are key conflict minerals that are actually being mined or the trade is being controlled by these armed groups. The first is tin. Over in Congo, it's called cassiterite ore. That's the mineral ore from which the metal tin is made. And tin, one of the main uses of that is as a solder on circuit boards in electronics. So just about any piece of electronics that's got a circuit board in there has tin that's used to connect the components to the circuit board. Then secondly, there's tantalum, which is pretty, may be well known by its, what it's called in the Congo, coltan, there was a lot of coverage of the so-called coltan boom back in 2001, 2002, when the price for coltan skyrocketed and you had a link to escalation in the fighting there. Coltan is an ore. It's turned into tantalum, a metal that is used to hold a charge in electronics. And so that's particularly used in cell phones and iPods and sort of portable electronics, but it's found in quite a number of products. Mm-hmm. Tungsten is another of the key conflict minerals. The three of those we call the three T's. Tungsten has a wide range of uses. A lot of it's in kind of heavy industry, even in defense. But among other things, it's used to for vibration with electronics. So I'm not sure if there'd be tungsten in your camera, but that's another key one. And then gold is the other. And gold, we know it's predominantly used for jewelry or by banks, but it's also used as a coating for wires and in electronic components.
Mm-hmm. So I guess how does the supply chain work, right? So how does this the minerals mined in predominantly in Eastern Congo end up in my camera? And do I know that my Canon camera here is sort of responsible for bloodshed in the Congo?
Well, you don't know. And that's part of the problem, is that this is really a sort of systemic issue throughout the electronics industry. No one is actually tracing these products back to their mines of origin. And so we can't say for sure right now whether a given company may or may not be using conflict minerals. But starting in Eastern Congo, the supply chain starts in mines that are located throughout North and South Kivu and the surrounding area of Eastern Congo, which has been the epicenter of the conflict that's been raging there. And not all the mines are actually controlled by the different armed groups, whether you have the FDLR, the Hutu extremist militias, whose leadership is linked to the Rwandan genocide, but they control a significant portion of the mines, especially in South Kivu. I believe they control about 50% of the mines in that province. You also have units of the Congolese army, which is unfortunately among one of the chief perpetrators of human rights abuses over there. Units of the Congolese army who are sometimes more autonomous than others. Sometimes they're completely renegade and not really controlled by the state whatsoever, are also involved in the mining, or sometimes even cooperating with their battlefield enemies, such as the FDLR, in order to profit from the trade. And then you have other, Mai-Mai groups and other kind of militias and armed groups who control the mines or tax the miners themselves or the trade in the minerals. The mines, and there's a great piece in the New York Times back in November where Lydia Pulgreen went out to one of the major mines, BCA mine in North Kivu, are what in the jargon they call, it's all artisanal mining, so it's used in really basic hand tools, tunnels into the ground, pretty horrific conditions, forced labor, child labor, severe, health and safety and environmental hazards. So armed groups will control the mines and or tax the trade through checkpoints as these mines make their way, sometimes literally on the backs of porters because there's no roads. So people are hiking through the forests to planes and trucks that take them into the sort of provincial capitals, Goma, Bukavu. And there you have exporters who are called comptoirs, who are the sort of trading houses that arrange for the minerals to be shipped out of the Congo, usually through the neighboring countries, Rwanda, Uganda, Burundi. And you have severe issues with the under-reporting and smuggling of these minerals as they leave the country because of both the corruption challenges that are kind of endemic in Congo, but also some real problems in terms of the export taxes. It's vastly more expensive to export minerals from Congo than it is from, say, Rwanda. So there's a real incentive for people to smuggle minerals across the border and to export from Rwanda. In terms of how these actually then get into our cell phones and laptops and electronics, the minerals are shipped usually out of the regional ports in Kenya and Tanzania over to mostly to Asia. And you have large smelting and processing companies that actually take the raw minerals and turn them into metals. And at that point, you really lose track of the supply chain because once the minerals have turned into metals, they can't easily be traced. And then they're sold through a series of intermediaries to component manufacturers and suppliers who sell the parts that electronics companies use to put together your phone or camera or laptop. So that's a very broad strokes what the supply chain looks like.
Mm-hmm. I guess I have a couple of questions about that supply chain. Which countries in Asia in particular are the major importers of the raw materials?
Well, The ones that have been identified in particularly by the UN and some NGOs doing investigative work have been Thailand and Malaysia, but also China, India. These are the big countries, and oftentimes they're countries where there are where these minerals are mined domestically, and so you'll have minerals from the Congo mixing together with minerals from, you know, Indonesia or Thailand or Malaysia or one of these places.
And my second question is, how much money are we talking about? You know, looking at the full sort of spectrum of the supply chain.
Well, it's you know, these are billion-dollar industries. We in our recent report, Comprehensive Approach to Congo's Conflict Minerals, tried to put a finger on the sort of order of magnitude of how much funding the armed groups in Congo are earning from the trade in minerals, and we came up with roughly $185 million a year.
For aggregated for all the armed groups, does that include the Congolese government?
That includes the sort of military and armed groups that are profiting, not the money that actually is accruing to the coffers of the state government. And that's very much, you know, basically, you know, we used what there's not a lot of information on this trade, and the data that's coming out of in, you know, Congolese export statistics is not very good. However, there has been, you know, considerable research done on this subject by various research groups and NGOs, and we've kind of taken a look at that and done this sort of rough back of the envelope calculations in terms of, you know, whether the exports are being underestimated by a third, and to what extent armed groups are actually controlling the different mines in the trade. So we've got a some tables that we've pulled together based on that, and we're really, you know, it's a well-educated guess, and we're hoping that that'll actually spur further conversation and further research that'll help us get a better grip on the extent of the trade.
I seem to recall reading in a, like, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but a good source probably for you was the UN panel of experts reports, the Security Council mandated reports on sort of on how and if Security Council mandated arms embargoes and embargoes on Eastern Congo are working. And they put out these periodic reports that have been sort of a wealth of information. And I remember reading at one point that sort of Rwanda was the world's leading exporter of coltan, although there's no coltan to be found within Rwanda.
Yes. Well, there is some coltan in Rwanda. Rwanda does have some mines and minerals, and I believe that Rwanda is really pushing its mining sector as an area of growth and development, but it doesn't have nearly the resources to sustain the sort of exports that they were reporting, suggesting that a lot was coming out of the Congo. And, you know, the issue of UN experts in Congo nowadays, it's actually called the UN Group of Experts rather than a panel of experts. There was previously a panel of experts, I guess, to make it all the more confusing. But they are a fantastic resource, and one that I think, especially for folks who are, you know, interested in how the UN can contribute to managing and resolving some of these conflicts, they're really a kind of critical resource that that doesn't get nearly the kind of attention and support that they deserve. I think the report by the UN Group of Experts that's tasked with monitoring the arms embargo that the UN has imposed on Eastern Congo that came out last December probably had more effect on regional dynamics and pushed had more of effect in terms of the conflict between Rwanda and Congo than you know, almost a decade of UN peacekeepers. And if you look at the funding and support for these sorts of things, you have you know, MONUC, the UN peacekeeping force in Eastern Congo, costs $1.2 billion per year. Meanwhile, I think that the budget for the UN Group of Experts, which is, I think, five or six guys men and women, is only $1 million per year. So a fraction of what it costs to sort of manage the symptoms of the conflict in Congo is being provided to folks who are investigating what are these underlying drivers of the conflict. And the UN group of experts has been an enormous resource in this regard.
You know, it seems, you know, I feel like when on people sort of think of the Congo, I feel like oftentimes, you know, they perhaps lump it in with any number of these so-called grievance ethnic conflicts, right, in Africa. But, you know, as you're saying, it seems to be more a matter of greed and more a matter of who, you know, the fighting is over who controls which mines in large part. And so to that extent, it would seem that one way to get to the root causes of the conflict, as you say, is to somehow regularize this trade.
Yeah, well, it's both. You know, it's both greed and grievance, and there's certainly ethnic dimensions to the conflict in eastern Congo, not only, you know, resulting from the Rwandan genocide, but dynamics going on within Congo with the sort of Rwandan, Congolese of Rwandan descent that go back decades and are quite complicated and have a lot to do with sort of control and access to land and issues of citizenship. There are, you know, the conflict in Congo is extremely complex, but the economic dimension is a key element that I think has been neglected in a lot of the efforts to try to resolve the peace there. And that's why, to an extent, I think you've seen, despite all of the progress at the international level from ceasefire agreements to peace negotiations, UN peacekeepers, transitional government, elections, and yet mortality rates and violence in eastern Congo continue to at the same rate. And I think the reason for that is because the various armed groups and militias have been able to sustain themselves through the trade in natural resources, particularly minerals, and that's kind of made the conflict resist resolution. And I think that if you can get a grip on that trade, and to the extent that you can get that trade going into Congolese government state coffers, where it can be used to actually rebuild the state and provide services and provide some benefits to the Congolese people, that's going to shrink the resources that are there for, you know, the spoiler armed groups who are benefiting from this status quo.
And, you know, obviously there are a lot of parallels, it would seem, between sort of the so-called conflict diamonds that rose to, you know, prominence in the 1990s in Western Africa, in Liberia, in Sierra Leone. And it seems that one way in which this issue of conflict diamonds was overcome was through the Kimberley process, which essentially was an industry alliance that said, you know, where the diamond industry was hurting financially from activists, you know, like calling their conflict blood diamond, calling their, you know, engagement rings blood diamonds. So I'm wondering if there is any similar sort of awakening in the electronics industry that perhaps they ought to get a grip on, you know, their role and responsibility for conflict in the Congo.
Well, that's definitely the model that we are looking to build off as we try to raise awareness and get a grip on the conflict mineral issue in eastern Congo. The diamond issue in the 1990s, both in Liberia and Sierra Leone and West Africa, and also in Angola and in Congo, during the earlier phase of the war from 98 to 2002, when you had, you know, foreign armies intervening in Congo, and where you had the front lines were all across the entire country, Congo's very wealthy sort of diamond-rich areas were object of both of armies on all sides of the conflict. As you said, you know, the Kimberley process was both a kind of industry and NGO and government-led initiative. And it was something where you had NGOs like Global Witness and others who were, you know, assailing the industry, and it wasn't until you got key actors in the industry, particularly De Beers, which had such a huge control over the diamond market, to buy in and say, okay, we need to do something about this, that you were able to see progress on the Kimberley process. And that is what we are just at the very beginning of trying to do right now. We recognize that this is not a issue that's going to be solved overnight, that even if you did get a grip on the minerals trade, that's only one aspect of a very complicated conflict, but it is a critical one that we need to start addressing. And so, you know, the Enough Project, we have started to engage with companies. We wrote to 21 of the largest electronics companies, the big name brands that we all recognize, the Motorolas and Hewlett-Packards and Apples, and started to really try to make the link between their products and this industry and what's happening in the Congo. We've done that building off of some initiatives that have already been going on in Europe. There's a European coalition of NGOs called Make IT Fair that have actually already started working with companies as well. So we're starting to get the ball rolling, but I think that until there is much wider awareness of the issue and the link, that we're not going to see the kind of momentum that was eventually able to take hold with the Kimberley process.
So are there any particular companies that you think are doing a good job on this, and any that you want to name and shame right here on Blogging Heads?
Well, like I said earlier, it remains a kind of systemic issue in the electronics industry, and by and large, the response so far has been from the industry as a whole through an industry association called the Electronics Industry Citizenship Coalition. So it's kind of a corporate social responsibility association of electronics companies. They've started to take some steps. They are actually commissioning research right now on what they call a transparency model for the supply chains for some of these key minerals, including tin and tantalum, that are, you know, conflict minerals. So far, what they're not doing is actually going back and looking and tracing their supply chains for their specific products back to the mines of origin. Instead, they're having some research done that's looking at who are the players in the supply chain, what are the steps, but without looking at where are they specifically getting their stuff from. As we're continuing to engage with companies, we've actually developed something called the Conflict Minerals Pledge, which essentially is a commitment that we want electronics companies to make to eventually becoming conflict-free, and doing this by tracing and auditing their supply chains for the conflict minerals. And we think that if you can do that, then you can start to get back and put pressure on the suppliers, who are the ones who really have the key choice to make between purchasing or not purchasing minerals that they think may have come from armed groups in Eastern Congo. That's not a boycott or a ban. What it is taking some responsibility for your supply chain and trying to influence it in a positive way. We've yet to get any companies to sign up to the pledge, but we think that that's something that that hopefully they will see is in their interest, and that's something that then we can use to hold out the sort of positive examples of what companies who are forward-leaning can do on this in order to pressure and indeed name and shame other folks in the industry and in the other industries that benefit from conflict minerals who are lagging behind.
Mm-hmm. And are there any other places in the world where companies might go as an alternative to find these minerals? And if they do decide to go elsewhere, it seems like there might be somewhat problematic in the sense that though much of the money goes to armed groups, as you say, they still would be depriving, you know, ordinary poor Congolese who, you know, still do derive an income, however small, from mining.
Yeah, no. That first of all, Congo is not the only source of these minerals, not by a long shot. Depending on the particular mineral, Congo is right now is about anywhere from 20% of the world's production of tantalum to as little as 2% of the world's production of tungsten. So there are other sources, but our understanding from the research that we've done is that the minerals are cheaper from Congo, and that's probably as a result of the conditions under which they are mined and the the forced labor, child labor. We've heard that coltan or tantalum coming out of Congo is half the price of that which is mined elsewhere, such as in Australia or Brazil. So at the same time that that there is starting to be some awareness and of the conflict minerals issue, the price pressure that's in the industry being exerted on these supply chains is continuing to encourage folks to source from conflict areas in the Congo. In terms of the point about, we don't want to sink the Congolese, mining sector as a whole. And the idea is not for companies simply to walk away from the Congo, which would be irresponsible, I think. And what we're seeking to increase is corporate responsibility, not irresponsibility. That said, I think that the specific issue of whether you would have, based on, if you generate enough awareness that enough companies would say, okay, let's turn our back on Congo. I'm skeptical that you're going to see that turn into a situation where you would have a real bottoming out of the mineral and the mining industry in eastern Congo, because I think that you have other actors who would step in, because there's just such a premium for getting these minerals on the cheap. That said, I think that there is any efforts that turn out to be effective in order to shift the status quo in eastern Congo and to change the practices in this industry so that folks start paying attention to who they're purchasing from and not purchasing from suppliers with obvious or with proven links to armed groups, is going to be very disruptive to this status quo, where you have entrenched sort of military, political, and criminal interests who've been benefiting from this trade at the expense of the Congolese people, and shifting that so that the Congolese people themselves start to see the benefits of this trade is going to be disruptive, and that there really needs to be a surge of support in terms of support for livelihoods for miners who might be temporarily put out of work, large-scale, labor-intensive infrastructure projects like road building. Eastern Congo, there's no roads. If you start to create those kinds of opportunities, that can mitigate what sort of short-term disruptions there might be in the mining sector, which would, I think, ultimately be worthwhile if it would lead to the decriminalization of this trade.